And our guest this hour, Dr. Bob Curran. We're going to talk about his continued work, A Haunted Mind, and also take your phone calls. Vampires, tops of the subject right here on Coast to Coast Day Out. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Dr. Bob Curran, A Haunted Mind. Bob, it's unfortunate that Lovecraft's work made it big after he died.
It is, George, and that not only did it make it big, it made it very big, because Lovecraft is almost, I'm tempted to say, an industry now. You have crossovers between this and the other works. I'm thinking of Batman and Arkham Asylum. My son actually plays that on his Xbox. So you have books, you have comics, you have films, you have video games, you have all these things. And as I say, I'm tempted to say Lovecraft has almost become an industry now, and you can buy all sorts of things connected. I think that actually, George, comes from the breadth and depth of his vision, because it allows everybody to sort of buy into the world of Lovecraft.
Who's making money out of
things? Some people write their own stories, and some people design their own video games. So it's all great stuff.
Who's making money off him?
That's a good question, George. I think people have begun to see that there is almost an industry there. And there have been books and games and stuff which was writing about or saying to you, going about, I'm looking across at some of the books. There's Chosium, which is actually based around Lovecraft, which is a company. And there are other, taking a look at along, there are a number of others. There's Green Goblin Press, I'm looking at. So there are people who are beginning to move into the Lovecraft. Now, there's nothing wrong with writing about Lovecraft, but it is now becoming an industry, and I'm terrified that it will, vanish in on itself. It'll become so big and so powerful that it'll take away some of the original horror that Lovecraft's shorter stories inspired in people like me, who was a small boy or small teenage boy living out in the wilds of nowhere and reading his stories by the light of a paraffin lamp. It's now become big, glitzy, and sort of, I'm told that there is some sort of Lovecraft thing being put together, which is now in 3D. And you can have some of these monsters come out of your television set or whatever you want in your own home. Now, that is frightening enough, but I still go back to my own experience sitting reading it by the light of a lamp.
Okay, let's go to the phones. First-time caller, Father Sebastian in the city of New York. Welcome, Father. Thanks for calling.
Hey, it's good to be here again. I'm admiring your knowledge base, Mr. Curran. It's very, very, very awesome to hear someone with such a diverse set of esoteric interests.
Thank you very much, Father.
My pleasure. I was actually a guest a couple of months ago on Coast to Coast when I was calling from Prague about vampire subculture.
Yes.
So I love to see the mythology, because I don't actually touch the mythology as much as you might. I actually deal with the real vampires living in New York and Prague and Paris. people who live the lifestyle. And it's also refreshing for me to see all the different diverse myths that have occurred in the past. But one of the things that I really would like to ask you is, what do you know about the Cthulhu or the Lovecraftian vampires?
Well, I think that they appear in some of Lovecraft's stories. Those who draw out from George and I were talking about it slightly earlier. People who have the power, or things which have the power, to draw out the energies from people. And I think these are, if I can use the expression, sort of Lovecraft's inner demons, in which sort of aspects of him. And I believe, and perhaps you know much more about this, Father, than I do, but I have dealt with people, and George and I were talking about this, who can almost draw out of you. Now, that is a sort of my way of describing it. Draw out of you the energies which leave you sort of listless, torpid, things like that, and who imagine themselves to be able to do this. People who think that by revitalizing themselves, they devitalize, if you like, other people. And I think this is almost in the Lovecraftian style, that there were things living beneath the hills of, let's say, Rhode Island, who drew the goodness out of the area and out of people. And genuinely, I personally believe that there are people who can do that, who can draw goodness from the people around them and from their own environment for their own purposes. But I think if you read Lovecraft and look at the sort of wizened landscape that he portrays, you're beginning to think of old things sleeping under the hills, which can draw the energies from all the healthy environment around it. So if you want to term those as vampires, then that's exactly what they are.
Bob, earlier this week, there was a report that creativity might stem from mental illness, or in, you know, a little bit being a little insane. Might Lovecraft have been that?
Well, George, you know that we have an old saying. There is only a very, very thin line between insanity and genius. And that may very well be the case. Some of our the way in which we deal with some of the things, if you want to say that torment us, can actually inspire us to write. Poe, for example, dealing with his own demons, put it down on paper and writing about these things in an attempt to deal with them is sometimes a very good way of dealing with them. So madness can be an inspiration, or I'm not suggesting that Lovecraft was mad. I am choosing my words carefully. He was a bit odd. Mm-hmm. But in dealing with the things which were pressing on him, that may have given him the depth of perception. That may have given him the impetus to write these things, and to write these things so vividly and inspire others.
Let's go to Seth in Billings, Montana. You're on with Dr. Bob Curran. Go ahead, Seth.
Hi, long-time listener, really love the show, miss art a lot. I just wanted to say that I'm a 31-year-old artist and musician, and I have read all of Lovecraft's works, and I have a great appreciation for his For his literature. I mean, come on, he's inspired so many artists. My goodness. I mean, there's a lot to say about this man, but what I want to say is that as a reader of his works, I have thoroughly enjoyed his words, his use of language, his use of tension. I mean, my goodness, the guy was an absolute master of tension. I mean, an entire story in the last couple of pages, it's like, you know, the payoff. But at any rate, he was just, for anybody that listens to this show, including myself, it's going to be a little odd. Lovecraft was definitely a little odd. And he was a really wonderful artist and writer. And aside from all of the, what am I trying to say? What I'm really trying to say is that I have
his strange habits
for him, and I just wanted to share that with you. And that his stories and his use of imagination and his use of tension throughout his stories to achieve an effect was absolutely wonderful.
All right, thank you, Seth.
They've really
that.
Inspired me.
I wonder if he just wasn't appreciated during his time, Bob.
I think that's right. And going back to what Seth has said, yes, his imagination was terrific. Like Seth, sitting out as I'm describing to you, I was inspired. And his use of language, now, his use of language is, I think, in many respects, second to none. He can find a right word. For example, a word like eldritch. Now, that in itself carries all sorts of connotations, and his use of language was superb, and that creates the tension, as Seth was saying. But I think, in answer to your question, George, that perhaps the readership of the pulp fiction was looking for other things. I mean, they took greatly to Robert E. Howard because he was giving tales of derring do and great barbarians stalking the landscape and battles, and people like Solomon Cain, who were expert swordsmen, Bran MacMorn, things like that, and the appeal. But Lovecraft himself was had a great imagination, had a great depth of imagination. And this is what, whenever we were speaking earlier about how he has managed to maintain it even down to the present day, this is, I think, what the depth of his vision, the intensity of his vision, and the scope which other people can into which other people can insert their own ideas, because people have written and are still writing Lovecraft-style stories.
He understood how to make you scared, didn't he?
He did, yes. Probably because he was scared himself. One of the things which I was told as a writer was to look inside yourself and see what scares you. If you're going to be a writer about ghosts, if you're going to be a writer about vampires or whatever, look inside yourself, see what scares you, and see how you can communicate that with people, because people are generally similar, George. What scares one can often scare another. So he genuinely knew, and you're quite right, what made people scared. And he knew how to communicate his own inner demons, if we can call them that, to the people outside. And this gave, because he was writing, if you like, and I hesitate to use this, but writing from the heart, or from the thing that scared him, that conveyed itself. And that's what gives his work the great impetus and thrust that it does.
Let's go to Grand Rapids, Michigan, east of the Rockies. Lee, you're on with Bob Curran. Go ahead, Lee.
I was wondering about your guest's take on L. Sprague de Camp, because I've seen and own some books written or co-written by L. Sprague de Camp with your authors. Oh, my Lord.
All right. Bob, what do you think?
L. Sprague de Camp, I have read some of his stuff. I try to read as much as I can. Some of his stuff I have seen in Lovecraftian mode. It's very interesting. It's as I say, I try to read it in context of a number of other authors, but he has written a whole gamut of stuff, and I've tried to read it. It's very good. Parts of it are very good. Parts of it I have enjoyed greatly. If you can read as widely as you can, people like Lynn Carter, people like there are a number of others as well, which you can have a look at. Yes, read L. Sprague de Camp, read Robert Bloch, read people like Lynn Carter, and try and get as wide a spectrum of Lovecraftian work as you can, because each one brings its own nuance, brings its own perspective, and brings its own take on the central Lovecraftian themes. So read as much as you can.
Bob, the last time you were on with us, we chatted a little bit about the world's creepiest places.
Oh, yeah.
You did a lot of research on that. I want to talk with you about that when we come back, and also take some final phone calls. A Haunted
Absolutely
Mind. Where do you get this book, A Haunted Mind?
A Haunted Mind can be bought from Amazon, from Barnes & Noble, and, as they say, George, from all good bookstores. Mind you, I have never come across a bad bookstore yet.
No, either have I. There may not be as many as there used to be, Bob, but they're still fun when you go there, aren't they?
Absolutely.
All right, stay with us. We're going to come back, talk a little bit about the world's creepiest places, and take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we'll have some open lines for you next hour when we move along with Coast to Coast AM, and when we come right back with Dr. Bob Curran, we'll take final phone calls with him on Coast to Coast AM. Back at you now with Dr. Bob Curran. Bob, the world's creepiest places. For you, which one has it been?
The one that I would choose, George, and they're all pretty creepy, but the one that I would choose because it was a personal experience was the one in the Western Isles, in a place called Alien Moor. The word is Gaelic and means great island. And it's a very lonely place. There's nothing on it but the ruins of an old abbey and a lighthouse, which was built at the beginning of the 1900s. And from that lighthouse, three keepers mysteriously disappeared at the beginning of 1900. Now, I was asked, would I go over, because I'm not all that far away from it. A few miles up the road, I can see the Western Isles. This is slightly more out. It's a place called the Flannan Isles, and there's been a poem written about it. But we went out to that. I was asked to go out to that from the island of Lewis, and we went out to that. The boatman dropped me off because none of the locals will set foot on the island because it's considered to be another place. It's a place, allegedly, where one reality moves in and out of ours. And It is a spooky place, George. He said, look, he said, I'll be back for you at about 5 o'clock at night. So I went up to the lighthouse, had a look around the lighthouse, went up to the old abbey. There's the ruins of an old abbey dating back to the 9th or 10th centuries, which was dedicated to St. Flannan, who gave the island his name. There was nothing on the island but the wind and the cry of seabirds and the continual roar of the sea. Because it's not, although it's a big island, it's not a massive island. So no matter where you are, you can hear vaguely the roar of the sea as well. And the wind howling in crevices in the rocks, and because there's no trees or anything on the island. The wind whistles through gullies and creates all sorts of things. And it's not 100% unimaginable that there could be something living on the island, or that this could be the gateway to another a reality or another dimension. So, and if you're there alone, George, with a backpack and trying to put the time in, trying to have a bite to eat in such a lonely place, you can imagine that you are the only person left in the world. And that is pretty frightening, George. So it was pretty creepy. The sound of the sea, the sound of the wind, the sound of the gulls. And watching the horizon at about, from about 4:30 onwards until the guy arrived back, and he was late. He arrived back at 5:30, and I was beginning to panic.
Let's go to final calls now, Bob. Let's go to Michael in Burbank, California. Go ahead, Michael.
Hello, George. I wanted to get in on this. I got in on his conversation, I think Dr. Bob, a little late. I just heard him talking about Lovecraft. In 82, 83, I used to hang around with Nikki Sixx. I know you know who he is.
Oh, absolutely.
Molly Cruz. And he was just getting into Lovecraft and Crowley, and we made a little trip up to Frisco to see what LaVey was about. And he's a carnival barker, so he's... didn't scare as much, but when we got back, we started to get into Crowley and Lovecraft, and he got me really scared. One time, he was reading a passage out of, I don't know what book it is, I know it was by H.P. Lovecraft, and he's going, now read this, because I'm going to work this into a song. We're sitting in his apartment. He's reading this, and the guitar picks that were sitting on his coffee table flew up into the air and stuck into the ceiling. And we said, all right, shut the book. Let's go to the Rainbow and get drunk.
Yeah, so enough of that, huh?
Yeah, so we're enough of that. So he went into, you know, to bring Satan into the early Motley Crue, like Shout at the Devil, and then he kind of dropped it at the record company's request, not his. And then he got scared and kind of dropped it. But I took it on in my band, and in 87... And it was a band, we're going to do every song, we'll base it out of the Satanic Bible, but that really doesn't have much. There's another book they have that's kind of like what to do if you're in the church, certain rituals. So we'd read that, and I'm reading it to the singer, and immediately all these lyrics came. First song was called Black Mass. Second song, Hellfire. Third song, Bloodsucker. Fourth song, Night of the Wolf. We still don't know what that one's about. And I would go, okay, let's stop this, because we're all getting freaked out, because he's just writing. He was from Germany. He didn't even understand English yet. And he was writing it in English so he could understand it. I go, how do you, okay. So we used it. We went along with that. That band just took a nosedive. The first show we did was publicized around all over California. Our first show was on TV, which was very strange. I mean, where are we getting all this help from?
Right.
I knew it was Old Scratch or, the devil. So that band took a dive fast, and we went into a van. I decided, let's go to vampires, and we'll keep the evil thing in there. So We have a graveyard as a stage. All the tombstones, we got the names of all the witches that were burned in the trials, the witch trials back in the, you know, Massachusetts area.
Yeah.
And so, and on all of them, we had an, you know, reverse pentagram. So that was, you know, bad enough. We did that. But me and the singer decided if we're going to be vampires, let's be vampires. So anybody that came up to us said, are you really a vampire? Go slit your wrist. So, and a lot of the females would love to do it. So they would do scratch it until they got blood, and we'd start drinking it. And this got around. So when we went on tour, you know, we're drinking blood in Texas, Arizona, Nevada, Utah, all over the West Coast, the Midwest. And me and him actually started to develop taste for blood.
Taste and tendencies.
We didn't get it. And I'm like, I think we got ourselves into something really, really bad because we couldn't get out into the sun. We get sick of the sun, but garlic and all that stuff, that didn't do anything. We could still see ourselves and put the makeup on the mirror.
How are you now, Michael?
Well, I left all that behind, went back to church, and 6 months ago, a record company says, we want to release all the albums, all this stuff that you had, the vampire band. It was called Fatal Attraction. We kind of want to release the first album on Halloween. What do you think? I'm like, it sounds like you're bringing hell back into my life.
That's right.
But I said, go ahead. Let's see what's how much money. But I'm not going to tour too much behind it because I just know the same thing's going to happen. I mean, you know, Lovecraft, you could go either way. I think he was just a little nutty. But there's a lot there to be learned as far as writing and, you know, his writing technique. If you want to scare the crap out of people, yeah. But, you know, when you mess with that stuff, that's not fun and games. No. It'll turn on you. It will.
You cannot play with it. We've got to move on, Michael, and take a few more other calls here. But this is something not to play with, Bob.
This is definitely something not to play with, George. I mean, not only can it mess up your mind, it can mess up your life big time. And I have talked to people. Part of my job, you may know, George, is working with people who have a number of problems. One of my doctorates is in child psychology, and I'm talking with people who have some sort of problem with. They may imagine themselves to be possessed. They may imagine themselves to be vampires. They may imagine themselves to be something else. So you have this obsession with, let's say, even if you want a Lovecraft or Dracula or whatever, can have repercussions, not only for yourself, because the other thing which I've had to look at is how these impact on their families and how they and on the people they love. This not only has big consequences, not only for yourself, but for those around you. And it is to be treated very, very carefully. I only look at it from a cultural viewpoint. Somebody asked me, was I a vampire? And I said, no. But I would draw back from getting involved too deeply in some of these things.
Let's go to Woodstock, New York. Joe's with us. Joe, you're on with Dr. Bob Curran. Go ahead, Joe.
Hi, George. I spoke to you the other night. I was the writer that called and spoke to Adrian about a dream I had, The Lion from J.D. Helfert.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, my background is I studied Gothic horror throughout college, and I've read everything that Edgar Allan Poe wrote and Lovecraft and, you know, all those great writers. And I do write in that style. And, you know, I just, I wanted to comment on, you know, and ask Bob about what he thought about contemporary writers like myself who are writing in this genre through this time. And as I told you, this was a dream that I had, and I used it as a vehicle, you know, for a story, one of my stories. But I think it's interesting, as he was saying earlier, that, you know, Lovecraft and a lot of these writers and artists are not recognized during their own time in a way. You know, they're thought of after the fact. Sort of after they passed away, their work has become recognized.
That happened. Same with painters and other artists like that, Bob. I mean, if they could have made the money that their paintings are making now, they'd be happy campers.
You betcha, George. I'm thinking, for example, of Vincent van Gogh, who only sold one painting in his own lifetime, and that for a mere pittance. But what Joe says is quite right. I mean, most writers draw, like myself, as a youth. I drew on Lovecraft as a sort of an inspiration. And most writers either write from their own experience or from things that really interest them and on which they get into. There's no harm in that. We need to worry that we don't become obsessed with a writer. I mean, as some people have written to me and say they want to live like H.P. Lovecraft. Now, I under no circumstances would I want to live like H.P. Lovecraft, but you can certainly draw from the genre, and there are many great writers about which you can begin to develop, which is it's useful for developing your own style, for your own commentary on the world. And I would, this is what I was saying earlier, if you want to write like H.P. Lovecraft, read as much as you can about them, because various other writers will have their own takes on Lovecraft, and you can develop your own take on Lovecraft. Just don't slavishly write H.P. Lovecraft. Begin to think of how you can develop that. Begin to think of how you can amend that bring a fresh perspective to it.
Let us go to David in New York, first-time caller. Hey, David, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm glad you took my call, George. It's great to hear your show again. And Dr. Bob, you're a great guest. You're covering one of my favorite topics. That's why I felt compelled to call. I mean, H.P. Lovecraft is one of my favorite topics, and his works are outstanding. And as you said, he obviously was a tortured individual. I guess my question is, do you feel in your book, I'm looking forward to reading it now, of course, but do you feel, and do you address in your book whether the imagination of H.P. Lovecraft, were these things that were driven maybe on a psychic level, something he saw, something he perceived in his dreams, or do you think it was just pure imagination, something he just put down on paper?
I'll take
my answer off.
That any writing is a sort of interaction between the writer and the world, and the writer and his audience, if you like. So I think part of the thing was that it was a psychological thing. He was dealing with some of the things in his life, some of the fears that he had. Remember that some of his protagonists descend into madness. Lovecraft was terribly afraid of becoming mad, like he imagined his father. His father had actually some sort of brain problem deriving from syphilis. But he was terrified of becoming mad, like he perceived his father and mother to be. He had thoughts of suicide. He always carried, as I said, a little bottle of poison about with him in case he had to take it, and he felt like he was taking his own life. He went into black periods, and possibly in these black periods, he produced some of his finest work.
Yeah, the creativity is there.
You have... It is. It's not simply an interaction, but his imagination was vast. So, in answer to your question, David, I think it's a combination of the two. It's his own imagination, but he's coping imaginatively with some of the things that are driving him.
I think so too. Bob, how many books have you written now?
George, this is going to sound very pretentious. In English, George, I have written 47.
That's amazing.
In English. I have written also in Russian. In fact, I'm appearing on Russian TV over Halloween and on the first channel. I have written in Urdu. I have written in Korean. I have written in I've written six books in Japanese. I don't speak all these languages. People translate them for me. I have written in Korean. I have written in Hebrew. I have written in French, Spanish, Portuguese. I'm just looking along my bookshelf here. I have written in Croatian. I have written in Italian.
Pretty darn prolific, Mr. Curran.
It keeps me off the streets, George. Goodness knows what I would get up to if I was let out.
Well, enjoy your Halloween and your upcoming holidays as well, Bob, all right?
Can I wish you, Tom, and all your listeners exactly the same, George?
You sure can. Dr. Bob Curran, latest work, A Haunted Mind, one coming out very soon, American Vampires. We're going to come back in just a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM with, guess what, Friday night into Saturday morning open lines. Plus, I'm going to open up a special hotline. I'll tell you about that when we come right back.